But since we don't usually get a chance to learn tzavet because it comes with truma, and most years you have to wait for a leap year. So here we are. We're going to learn tzavet. Now, broadly speaking, the parasha of truma, the parasha of truma is about klei hamishkan, the vessels that were built in order to be used in the mishkan. The primary vessels, of course, are the Aron, the Shulchan, the Menorah. Right, the Aron HaKodesh, in which the Aseret HaDibrot were kept. The Shulchan, we spoke about last week, that had the bread on it. In English they call it showbread, S-H-E-W, for maintaining some old English style or other. You know, King James is still the only translation of the Bible into English. All the other translations are just make-believe. Except Kaplan. Kaplan is new.
Aryeh
Kaplan's translation, he did it himself. But all the other translations that we use, JPS and Korean and all of that, they're all King James. All of them are King James. I hope that doesn't make you nervous.
Was
what?
It was based on
That's called tradition. Yeah. It's hard to do something, just do it. I've had a lot of people involved, also the King James translation. You know, a lot of people, some of them knew Hebrew, some of them knew Latin, some of them Greek. It was like a mishmash, because the earlier translations were used by the King James people to make their new translation. In any event, that's neither here nor there. So in the parasha of Truma, we mostly deal with klei hamikdash, hamishkan, the vessels that were built. And in the parasha of Tetzaveh, the parasha is primarily about bigdei kahuna, about the they were complicated and special and in a certain way. Big day kahuna. But the beginning of Parashat Tetzaveh, which is what concerns us tonight, the very beginning of Parashat Tetzaveh, is something different. It's something special. So let's look at the beginning of the Parashat Tetzaveh. You see, it says, V'atah Tetzaveh b'nei Yisrael, V'atah. Right, started off with a direct statement to Moshe Rabbeinu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Atah. Now that itself is not so common. He says, Atah, Tetzaveh et B'nei Yisrael. Okay, we'll see all the Rishonim deal with the problem. And then, what is the Tzivui? V'yikhu Elecha, Shemen, Zayit, Zach, Katit, Lama'ot. Shemen, oil, Zayit. Olive oil. The other words we'll see in a minute are explained by Rashi. But it's very fine olive oil and lima'or. Lima'or is the word or, right? It has the word lima'or in order to produce or, to make or, to become or. Light. Where was the light? Of course, was in the menorah. How can you? It's sort of like telling you what the menorah is there for, which itself is not so obvious, because it's not clear to us what this menorah was supposed to do. Because you know that the that the menorah was lit every night, I think I've mentioned it before, and it burnt all night long until the morning, when the Kohen would come in and clean up the place where the oil was put in new oil and wicks, etc. Now, at night, there was nobody in the Beit HaMikdash, in the Mishkan. It wasn't as though they had a night kolel in the Beit HaMikdash. They did not. And so why the candles were lit at night until the morning, where there was no one there to be able to benefit from them, is not obvious. The answer is not obvious, but this is the reality. The candles were lit. They used olive oil to light the candles. And And it says, La'alot ne'a tamid. Ne'a tamid, and here Rashi will explain what the word tamid means, as we tried to do last week. The second pasuk is, Ba'al mo'ed mi'chutz la'parochet asher al ha'edut. Now the word edut refers to the to luchot ha'edut, to the commandments, to the stones that were in the aron, and the parochet is the thing that separated the room of the aron kodesh from the room of the menorah. So you remember I told you that the words are ulam, right? The big courtyard is called ulam, then heichal is the smaller room, and devir is the smallest room. So in the devir there was the edut, and the edut was separated from the shul, from the menorah, by a parochet, by a curtain, right? Asher al ha'edut yarochoto Aaron banav me'er vadboker. Aaron banav, Aaron and his sons will do it. Whatever you do to the candelabrum, me'er vadboker lifnei Hashem, lifnei Hashem. I mean, it sounds good. Lifnei Hashem, everything should be done lifnei Hashem. But what specifically it means here is not clear. Chukat olam ledoro tam. Chukat olam, it's a regulation that is forever, all the generations, me'et b'nei Yisrael, from b'nei Yisrael. So that means what b'nei Yisrael continue to contribute all the time, I guess, is the oil. I mean, you don't have to build a new menorah every so often, but you do have to have new oil. For a variety of reasons. So if I read the pasuk again, so this is a special directive to Moshe Rabbeinu to tell B'nai Yisrael that they have to bring olive oil. that's what it says. Now let's look at Rashi. Rashi says, Shmarim is a word that describes sediments. You know, like often the juice comes out of fruit, and then if you let it stand there, some of it will sediment out. There's another word in English that is used for those of you who like English. You know, the English of English? Lees. You know that word? It's a good word for Scrabble, I guess. Lees. I just say it because it appears in some translations. So Belishmarim, Kilosh Shadinu, etc. Now the word Katit, you see the second Rashi, Hazeitim, Hayakotesh Bakhtesh, you would smash up the olives in an olive smasher. Ve'eino tochein berechayim, but you don't crush them with rechayim. Rechayim was stones, right? Millstones, okay. Right, because then you crush it too much. You can't distinguish the good, the best oil from the second best oil. So you still do it that way. So there should be no sediment. And after you take out the first bit of oil, then you take the rest of the olives and put them back into the millstones. Okay. So this is what the words mean. Zach, pure, katit, lema'or. The first squeezing of the olives produces the oil that you use in the menorah. Right? La'alot ner tamid, madlik, achidei shalevet olevi eileha, la'alot. It's a strange verb. La'alot ner. La'alot to bring up a nair. I mean, what is that? So Rashi explains what Rashi explains. We'll get into that now. Now the word tamid, I'm going to read the Rashi only because it explains what we spoke about last week. So those who remember, he says, "Kol laila v'laila karui tamid." Even though the menorah was only lit at night, and only lit for the night, I wasn't lit at all during the day. It nevertheless is called tamid, because tamid means a systematically repeated action. That is tamid. He says, Kemo she'atah omer, olah tamid. But the same thing we said. We said, so I just didn't have it on the sheet last week, saying, na ela miyom miyom, that the olah tamid, right, only is sacrificed day by day, but it's still called tamid. V'chein v'minchat chavitin, when you make the mincha, the chavitin are cakes, are like little cakes that were made from flour, which is the mincha offering. It says tamid, v'eino ela machzita b'boker machzita b'erev. They made these cakes to be eaten along with, you know, when the korban tamid was given, and part was eaten in the morning, part in the ela of tamid. Amur b'lechem apanim mishabat l'shabatu. But the word tamid, when describing, used to describe the lechem apanim, which is what we said, we talked about last week, was according to Rashi, the Shabbat the Shabbat, that the bread was on the table for an entire week, and then it was exchanged for new bread, and so that you could say that there was bread on the table all the time. It's a different kind of tamid. Okay, all's good. Now let's look at the Rashbam. You see the Rashbam? What? Rashbam is next to the Rashi. You remember the Rashbam was Rashi's grandson and the inheritor of Rashi's mantle. The reason I know that, or the reason I could say that, is because those places of the Talmud, that Rashi did not get to, did not finish, did not work out completely, were explained by the Rashbam. He inherited that job. Now, while it's probably true that neither the Rashi nor the Rashbam did it exclusively, I mean, it wasn't like Rashi just sat down someplace and wrote it up, but he had a lot of help. He had Talmudim. He actually here in Israel today, call it a mitzvah, right? You got work for people. In those days, I don't think it was called a mitzvah, but Rashi did it, and the primary inheritor of Rashi's mantle was apparently the Rashbam, who wrote a different kind of commentary, but he had the same ideas that Rashi had. He was a Talmid of his grandfather's. That's Rashi. So what does the Rashbam say? The Rashbam, you have to say on Chumash, the Rashbam, you always have to remember, the Rashbam was a Talmid of his grandfather. And if you look at the beginning of the parasha of Vayeshev and Bereshit, there's an introduction of the Rashbam to his own commentary. And there he says, I wanted to write this commentary to kind of flush out Rashi, to write up things that Rashi forgot about or didn't include. So I went to my grandfather and I asked him, is it all right if I do this? Would it be considered insulting to you if I did it? So Rashi said, absolutely not. I encourage you to do it. And he created that phrase, Lefi HaPshatim HaMitchatshim B'chol Yom. Because Rashi said, there are new things that happen all the time, new understandings, new explanations, and it's important that they get included and not excluded. And so the Rashbam wrote his commentary. What does he say here? Atat etzaveh, lemalahu omer, above, in the parasha of Truma, daber b'nei Yisrael yikuli Truma, speak to b'nei Yisrael, and they shall take a Truma, an offering for me, l'fi sha'ah l'tzorach ha-mishkan. Because that pasuk above where it says, V'yikuli truma, it says daber el b'nei Yisrael. It doesn't say tzav et b'nei Yisrael. It doesn't say command them. It says speak to them. Because of the fundraising that Moshe Rabbeinu did for the Mishkan was a one-time event. That was it. You know, it's like the raffle is going to be Rosh Chodesh Iyar. You want to get in on it? You have to buy a ticket for the raffle now. That's how it was with Moshe Rabbeinu, who raised the money for building the Mishkan. Avokan. Here, the Pasuk says, command them, because we're talking about a recurrent obligation. An obligation takes place, and then when you run out of the oil, you have to do it again. And you have to feel the obligation is ongoing and endless. That's what the Rashbam explains. Shina lashon, mafishikol lashon, sava'a ledorotu. There's the Rashbam. Wherever it says in the Torah, command, letzavot, that uses that word, it means forever and ever and ever. It's like tamid. Again and again and again. And this is also again and again and again a kind of topic. V'cheinu omer v'torat kohanim v'sifrei kikol lashon tzivui eino ela miyad u'midorot. And he says this is clearly stated in Chazal, in rabbinic literature, that wherever it says tzivui, wherever that verb is used, the verb litzavot, it means forever. It's like a mitzvah. So it's not as though if Moshe Rabbeinu would have said part of the truma that you bring is oil, so then they would have to do fundraising over again when they ran out of the oil. They have to go find the oil again. I mean, this sheds some light, a different kind of light on Hanukkah, on this, the oil of Hanukkah, but we're not going to do that now. Okay, if you turn the page, it's printed the way it's printed. So we're going to look at Vayikra Perikav Dalit, Pasuk Aleph Bet Gimel Dalit. Vayikra Perikav Dalit, the parasha is called Emor. In the parasha of Emor, there are many dinim that are connected to Kohanim. What Kohanim must do, what they should avoid doing, right? bereavement, Kohanim and bereavement, all of these things are covered in the parasha of Emor. Besides that, right, you know, we're in the parasha of Tetzaveh, right? That's the end of Shmot. And this is Emor is in the middle of Vayikra. So what do the Psukim say? They say, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe l'emor tzavet b'nei Yisrael v'yikru elech Hashem en zayit zach kafit l'mo'or la'alot be'et amid. So this seems to be quite repetitive. I mean, we know this already. This was already done. Why is God saying to Moshe Rabbeinu, do it, when God has already told Moshe Rabbeinu to do it? Pasuk Gimel, Michutz LaParoch, et Haidut Ba'ol Mu'ed, Yeroch Oto Aron, Mi'erev Ad Boker, V'Vnei Hashem, Tamid, Chukat Olam L'Dorot Hashem. I'm reading it like this because it's the same as the psukim we've already learned in the parasha of Tetzaveh. In the parasha of Tetzaveh, one more pasuk, Ala Menorah HaTahorah, Yaroch Et HaNerot, V'Vnei Hashem, Tamid. Okay. I mean, so here it says Menorah Tahorah, somebody has to tell us what that might mean. But basically, what the Pesukim are saying is that Moshe Rabbeinu should command B'nai Yisrael about the oil. And that command has already been done for B'nai Yisrael in our parashah, the parashah of Tetzaveh. Whenever the Torah repeats things, it's a sign. At least for Chazal, it was always a sign that there's some kind of new interpretation that should be squeezed out of the material. So let's look at first at Rashi. Rashi says, Tzavet b'nei Yisrael, zo parashat mitzvat ha-neirot. This is about the candles. O parashat ha-avatat tzaveh, Lo ne'emra ela al seder melechet ha-mishkan. Now you see these words? Lefaresh sorech ha-minorah. So Rashi, like in one swoop, has done away with the problem. Because he said that in the parasha of Tetzaveh, it doesn't include a command to bring oil. But what does it say? Atat Tetzaveh. When will Moshe Rabbeinu command Bnei Yisrael? When will Moshe Rabbeinu command Bnei Yisrael to bring the oil?
I don't know.
When they need it. When they need the oil. The parasha of Tetzaveh, nothing is built yet. Nothing is made. There's no Mishkan. Right? You remember how the end of the book of Shemot goes? Teruma, Tetzaveh, Kelim, Bigdei Kuna. Then the parasha of Ki Tetzah. The parasha of Ki Tetzah is primarily known as the parasha of the Egel HaZahav. Right? So like if you read the Torah in order, the Teruma and Tetzaveh kind of preempting the future. It's going to be that way. There'll be a Mishkan and there'll be Kelim. And then there's the Egel HaZahav. Moshe Rabbeinu fighting for the continued existence of the Bnei Yisrael. And then the last two parashiyot in the book of Shemot by Yakel Fukudei, which are again a discussion or a description of building the Mishkan. So Rashi says in Vayikra that when Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu Atat Tetzaveh, it wasn't the command. It was what's going to be. But when was the command to tell Bnei Yisrael to bring olive oil given to Moshe Rabbeinu to give to Bnei Yisrael? Here in the parasha of Emor. So what is, why was it that God said Atat Tetzaveh in the parasha of Tetzaveh? Because the Torah is explaining to us why there's a menorah. Because when in the parasha of Truma, when the menorah is described, it doesn't say what the purpose of that menorah is. Even though b'di'eved, it's certainly obvious to us that if you light candles in menorah, that's what the menorah is for. But you know that since the candles were lit at night and burnt until the morning, it was far from obvious why you needed a menorah at all. So the parasha of Tetzaveh tells us why there was a menorah. That's the position of that's the position of Rashi. That is the position of Rashi. Okay? Okay. Now we're up to the Ramban. You see the bottom of the page? The Ramban. Now the Ramban doesn't like Rashi. We know that the Ramban is not going to like Rashi. Because the Ramban had this fundamental disagreement with Rashi about order. And according to Rashi, Ein Mukdam U'Muchab HaTorah doesn't bother Rashi. How do I know that it doesn't bother Rashi? Because if you look through every case in Rashi where he says Ein Mukdam U'Muchab HaTorah, which means that the chronology is of no concern. The Torah doesn't write necessarily chronologically. Rashi never explains why it's not chronological. You would think that if the Torah wrote, okay, the Torah can do it. Rashi says the Torah can do it, but there should be a reason, shouldn't it? Isn't there a obviously, you would think the Torah would write something chronologically. And with digressions from the chronology, there should be a reason. But Rashi doesn't tell us the reason. Because Rashi seems to feel, well, it's like I always tell you that in the beginning of Psachim, Daf Vav on the Bet in Psachim, there is a reference to Ein Mukdam U'Muchab HaTorah, because in the beginning of the book of Bamidbar, it says clearly, but they're talking about Chodesh HaSheni, Chodesh Lashana Shenit, the second month of the second year. And Perek Tet, where the topic is Pesach Sheni, you know, all the people who were Tameh on Pesach couldn't bring a Korban Pesach, so there was this Korban, this Pesach Sheni, which somehow is rejuvenated naturally by the Hasidim, and the Litvaks can't put up with it, so they give in, you know, and all these kind of things. And so the people who eat matzahs, you know, matzahs on Pesach Sheni, which is a month after Pesach, that's what you do with your leftover matzahs. So the Torah says, the beginning of Bamidbar is B'chodesh HaSheni, but the Peretet in Bamidbar must have been B'chodesh HaRishon, because they came to Moshe Rabbeinu and they say, we're Tamei, we know we're not going to be able to give a Korban Pesach, what should we do? So they must have said that before Pesach, right? B'chodesh HaRishon. Okay, but the Torah doesn't tell us, but and Rashi doesn't tell us, the Gemara doesn't tell us why. Why the Torah is written in this way. So Rashi, I guess, feels that if you find a disagreeable chronological point, it's not so important. It doesn't have to be explained. That's Rashi. The Ramban disagrees. And he says the only time you could say that the chronology is of no concern is when the Torah itself tells you that the chronology goes awry. Like Pesach Sheni, it says the second month, and then it says the first month. Otherwise, you can't just introduce the principle of Ein Mukdam Mukhava Torah, as though it was a legitimate Parshanut principle. So Rashi, the Rabban disagree on this point, on what Torah is, whether Torah has to follow that rule or not. So he says, the Ramban says, Zo parashat mitzvat haneirot, parashat vatat tzaveh, lo memra el haseder. This is Rashi, right? Lashon Rashi, in the third line, right? He says, Veinenu nachon beinai, the Ramban says, the third line in the Ramban. She'ein ha-parasha yismucha le-parashat ha-menorah. Because the beginning of Trum of Tetzaveh does not come after the menorah in Truma. If it was there to explain what the menorah was doing, it should come right after it. But it doesn't. She'ein ha-parasha yismucha le-parashat ha-menorah. U'kvar ne'emar v'yal ha-neirot l'fnei Hashem. Kasher tziva Hashem et Moshe. This is already, we know this already, that the candles were already lit. V'inei ha-mitzvah v'ha-maaseh nizkarim v'nazim kvar. Kvar meaning before the parasha of Emor. Right, Vayikra is Emor. Tetzaveh, the end of Shemot. V'inei ha-mitzvah v'ha-maaseh nizkarim v'nazim kvar. Aval. Sorech ha-parasha ha-zot l'shnei dvarim. He says Rashi is entirely wrong. They already brought the oil and they lit the candles, and so the question becomes, according to the Ramban, what do you need the psukim in Emor for? Why are they in the Torah at all if you know everything? So he says, Yineh mitzvah ha-asem nizkarim v'nasim kvar. Aval tzorech ha-parasha hazot l'shnei dvarim she-sham tziva v'yikru eilech Hashem etzai etzach v'yed b'nei Yisrael, klomar v'yed kol ish asher nimtza ito Hashem etzai etzach v'na'or imshar trumot ha-mishkan v'chein asum k'vo sh'ne'emar v'anesi'im eviyu v'gomer et ha-bosem v'et ha-shemen l'ma'or. So it's in the parasha of Truma, the oil was donated in Tetzaveh. The oil was donated by the people who had oil. It's like everything else was donated. The wood was donated, people had wood, and the cloth was donated by the people who had cloth. The oil was donated by people who had oil. V'achshav kala ha-shemen ha-hu she-heviu ha-nesi'im nidavar. Now we ran out of that oil. The first donation of oil was finished. V'tziva she-ikhu b'nei Yisrael v'shel tzibu l'dorot ha-chem shemen zayit zach petit k'shemen ha-rishon. And now, so there has to be a new command to take more oil from Bnei Yisrael, because the original oil that was given under the aegis of Truma, as you donate what you have, everybody donates what they have, that disappeared. So in theory, no one had to bring any oil. Nobody knew what to do. So you needed another tzivui. You needed another tzivui. Okay. And then he goes on and he quotes several other things that are similar. So what's the difference? What is the difference between Rashi and the Ramban? What's the difference between Rashi and the Ramban? The Ramban says that things are written in order. That's what the Ramban says. Things are written as they should be, in the order that they should be written in. So Rashi says that the parasha of Tetzaveh really should be eliminated. It really didn't exist, because it's only there to explain to us what the menorah was for. Here, Rashi says in the parasha of Emor, that's where the real tzivui, comes. So Rashi has to do a kind of a surgical operation here, and sort of like cut out those psukim in Tetzaveh as being of primary importance, and relegate them to some secondary commentary position. They're the commentary. The Ramban says, no, that's not true, that you needed two commands for the oil, because the first command to bring the oil was the general command of Truma, which was that everybody donates what they have. So the people who donated the oil. But then after they finished, there was no longer any need to donate the gold and the silver and the cloth and the oil. There was no specific command about that, and therefore there had to be another command brought or given to Bnei Yisrael to bring the oil. So we see that that at least in the for the earlier commentaries for the Rishonim, the idea that these two parashiyot exist and that the oil was specifically considered of being of great importance is there, like the Rashbam, Rashi, the Rashbam, and the Ramban. Those are the Poshim that we looked at. Now, the last commentary that I think we will benefit from is the Hamek Davar. You know, the Hamek Davar was the Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin for many years, and actually closed the yeshiva. He was the one who closed the yeshiva when it was clear to him and to others that the Russian government would not allow the yeshiva. I mean, it's like deja vu, you know, deja vu. The Russian government would not allow the yeshiva to continue and producing boors. And, you know, I mean, I guess, of course, everything is connected to anti-Semitism on one level or the other. But the Russian government was incited, supposedly, by the reformers who said that these were not institutes of higher learning, but they were institutes of higher ignorance. And there is a story that is told. It took the government a long time to do this because there's a story, I think I've told the story. They had a student, a Baal Tshuva, in Volozhin, who had one of these tricky memories and knew all of the books of Pushkin Baal Peh. And whenever the Russian guys would come to investigate these issues, they'd say, oh yeah, we teach this, we teach that. And to prove it, they would wheel out this kid who would, like, then talk about Pushkin and quote lengthy paragraphs And it took them a while before they understood that he was an exception and not the rule. But the Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, was the son-in-law of the former Rosh Yeshiva of the Lodzhin. And he was the one, he was Rosh Yeshiva 40 years, and he closed the yeshiva. He closed the yeshiva because he realized he would not be able to function as he wanted it to function, as you know, as it should have functioned. And so he moved to Warsaw, where he eventually died. Whoever's been to Warsaw, you've probably been to the graveyard, and there's an oel, we like to call it, a tent that's made, of course, out of cement and stone, in which Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and the Netziv are buried together in the same place. So if anybody's looking for inspiration, you know, that's a good place to stop. So the Netziv, in the yeshiva, one of the things he instituted was that every morning after davening, he taught Chumash. This was radical because no one in any yeshiva, in fact, no one since that time ever taught Chumash in a yeshiva. Well, there are some exceptions, but you know, in the mainstream Lithuanian yeshivas, they don't teach Chumash. And that the people don't know the Chumash, I didn't say that. But there's no like formal, but the Netziv did. For years and years and years, and his teaching of Chumash in the yeshiva turned into a commentary on Chumash, which is called the Ha'anek Davar, and on which he wrote a commentary, right? He wrote, like a Jewish thing. He wrote the commentary in the Chumash, and then having done that, he wrote a commentary on his commentary. And the commentary is printed with the commentary, and it's called Harchev Davar. Like more of the same, you know, like let me like really go at it. And the Harchev Davar is usually it's like a shayur, it's like a shir kloli in the yeshiva, you know, it brings together sources that you might think, you know, might wonder what possible connection could there be to what it is we are talking about, but he makes those connections. He was quite a remarkable personality. The Netziv, and you know, he lived through a lot of. He was the primary teacher and the primary fundraiser for the yeshiva, which is itself a remarkable thing. So, in any event, he wrote this commentary, which we're going to try to read some parts of. I leave it with you if you'd like to like work on it a little more. So look how he starts. He says, on the first page, page one and the second half of the page, right? Klal parasha zo nifla'a. This is a wondrous parasha. Levad lishon vatatitzaveh shekvar adur rishonim alzeh. Besides the problem of the word vatatitzaveh, right, in the future, od ikar apeirush enkan nikoma betok maseh mishkan. He says, like, remember the Ramban? He said, this doesn't really belong here. Rashi says, doesn't really belong in Parashat Tetzaveh. Ayam mikomach rei maseh menorah al kol panim. Certainly, it should have been included after the menorah, the discussion of the menorah in Parashat Truma. Gam lishon v'yikhu elecha. What did he bring to you? For Ramban Katav, he's summarizing. She is here, she yivu lefanav. That they should bring it. This is the Ramban in Tetzaveh, which we did not learn, but we see it here. Yes, here she yivu lefanav. Moshe yireh im huzat v'katit kara'uy. The Ramban says maybe Moshe Rabbeinu had a special role here. Since the oil has to be pure, maybe he was the one who checked to see if the oil that they brought was really pure. So he says, "Eino mevo'am maze." For Ramban katab sheisish yaviul v'cholav Moshe yirei musaf mekatik kira'ui. The fourth line. Ve'eino ela pele. How come this was suddenly a big problem? Anybody can check if the oil is pure. And he says, what's going to happen after Moshe Rabbeinu dies? I mean, he's not going to be there to check if the oil is pure or not. I mean, what's the big deal? What is the big deal? Umay Yachay Mos Moshe Od Yesh Lahair Al Ma'amar Chazal Bevayikra Rabbah Al Pasuk Tzavet Reisir Kloy Lecha Shemin Zayit Zach. And then the Hamek Dovor goes through a very long explanation about the place of Moshe Rabbeinu, and he I'll try to summarize at least one idea that comes out of the words of the receiver. I again suggest that anybody who has the energy should try to go through it. The receiver said that there are two grand notions in the Mishkan. There are two things that are grand, but they also seem to be contradictory. One is that the Aseret HaDibrot, the luchot that were received by Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai, which we can say represents the Torah Shebichtav and the interpretations of the Torah Shebichtav, which I have many times tried to explain, it's not Torah Shebal Peh. In other words, if the Torah Shebichtav says, "Vayu totafot b'neinecha," right, totafot, Moshe Rabbeinu is going to teach B'nai Yisrael. It's inconceivable. There isn't one nudnik in the class who says, "What is that?" There's no reason to imagine that anybody knew what totafot was. Totafot is probably, it's certainly not a Hebrew word. It may not even be a Semitic word. That's all I say to you. Some nudnik said to Moshe Rabbeinu during the class, "What are totafot?" And Moshe Rabbeinu had to show him what they were. And that's called Torah Shebichtav. Because if you can't explain what totafot means to the student, then you don't have anything. There's no text. A text which is incomprehensible doesn't exist. You can't say God gave B'nai Israel the text. It's like God giving B'nai Israel the Torah written in Chinese. So was it given? No. I mean, you can say that. I'm not arguing here. I'm just saying you can say it was not given. So Moshe Rabbeinu had to explain the text of the Torah to B'nai Israel, otherwise they can't have been recipients of that Torah. They cannot have been recipients of that Torah. So when I say that Moshe Rabbeinu received the Torah at Har Sinai, one can argue that Moshe Rabbeinu received the Torah Shebichtav, right? Whatever it's a one day or 38 years, I mean, it doesn't matter. But he also received the direct interpretation, the explanation of those words in the Torah, which he then passed on to B'nai Yisrael as he taught them the Torah. So even things that seem to us to be very halachic, like I'd say, the Torah says, "V'sukot teshvu shirat yamin." Now, sukkah has a special definition, as we all know. It has tach on it, it has walls around it, it has the sides. There are places you could put a sukkah, places you can't put a sukkah. All of that was part of what we call Torah Shebichtav. That's the written Torah, because that's the comprehensible written Torah. So when somebody says that Moshe Rabbeinu received the Torah Shebichtav and the Torah Shebaalpeh on Har Sinai, that may be what he means, what I say. But anyway, that's what I mean. That's all right for me. I don't know if it's all right for you. But you understand what I'm trying to say. That whatever it is, it has to be comprehensible. It has to be comprehensible. If it's not comprehensible, it's not there. It doesn't exist. It's like giving, you know, everybody knows, we all have that experience, you know, things that you first saw that you couldn't understand at all, and then you did understand them, and when you looked at it again, right, whether it was an equation in mathematics, or it was, a difficult line in short order. So after you understand it, that understanding gets put back into it. You never look at it again. Like today, when we read the Pasuk, Vayu Tov Tavod Ve'Nineveh, everybody like can picture somebody wearing tefillin. I am not referring to the girls in the SAR. So you see, you could picture Tov Tavod. Everybody knows what Tov Tavod is, but before somebody told you what it meant, you didn't know what it meant. Couldn't imagine what it is because you had no way of connecting it to anything. It didn't exist. It was non-existent. But then once it's explained to you, every time you read the Torah Shebichtav, you know it. You don't start from zero over again. You know what it says. So, the Aron HaKodesh in the Beit HaMikdash was the thing that represented the immutability of the Torah. It was what it was, and it could be contained in a box. There were like limits. The Torah Shebichtav had a limit, and it was all of the things that the Torah Shebichtav meant. It wasn't just the words of the Torah Shebichtav, but it was the meaning of the words of the Torah Shebichtav. All of that could be contained. It was taught by Moshe Rabbeinu to Bnei Yisrael, and that was the end of it. So that was one metaphor that is represented in the Mishkan. And the other metaphor is the light of the candles. And the light of the candles that were lit every night until the morning, you know, is totally different kind of light. I remember this discussed by Sicha of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, like, I can't remember what year. I don't remember what year. She says that in the Beit HaMikdash, when Shlomo HaMelech built the Beit HaMikdash, the windows were Shkufim Atumim. Shuvim Atumim are the windows of the Taggart Fort, of which there are many examples in northern Israel. None of them are so close to swimming, but if you go up north in the Galil, you can find Taggart Forts left over from the days of the Crusaders. A Taggart Fort is, you recognize this, the windows are narrow on the inside and wide on the outside, like that. So that when you stood with your crossbow at the window, at the attacking raiders or something, you were mostly protected because the other guy's arrows would probably hit the cement wall, and you could see a lot and try to get the other guy. So that was how they built the Taggart Forts. According to the Rebbe, that was what Shkufim Atumim meant. That the windows of the Beit HaMikdash were Shkufim Atumim. So it's true that the light of the Beit HaMikdash did not light up anything. There were no people learning Torah in the Mishkan or the Beit HaMikdash at night. But the implication was that the light of the Torah, which was contained in the Aron Kodesh, could be spread throughout the world of the Jews, and the Netziv says that has to do with chidushim, with novel light. novel notions that come to people who learn Torah. New ideas, new solutions, new ways of looking at things. And even though it is true that the candles were lit by, I mean, this is what the thief tries to prove, that even though the candles were lit by Aaron HaKohen, they were really the result of the understanding of Moshe Rabbeinu. So Moshe Rabbeinu, according to the Nitziv, was responsible for both. He was responsible for the Torah that was in the Aron Kodesh, that immutable Torah, the Torah that is the way it is, and that includes the Torah Shebaal Peh, of how you read it and how you have the basic understanding on the one hand, and then the Torah of the light that just goes out forever to all the people and all the Jews that enables them to create, to be creative about the Torah, to be interesting about the Torah. I mean, you know, of course, these are bad words to use because they they have very different meanings. But generally speaking, Am Yisrael has managed to assume this position of, on the one hand, constancy, right, with the tradition, with the way it always was, the way it was always understood, and on the other hand, novel ideas and new ways of understanding and directing. Of course, this doesn't mean that anybody who comes up with any idea is part of this process, but you've got to be very firmly rooted. That's what the Rambam says. The Rambam says it not about Torah Shebistam, but he said about Havayos, Abaye Verovo, right? The Rambam says that if you want to learn philosophy, you better know a lot of Gemara first. That's what the Rambam says. He calls Gemara Havayot, Abaye Verovo. That's what it says in the Gemara. Right? All the cases that Abaye Verovo had to deal with. So the Rambam felt strongly that you can ask every question and you can deal with every problem, as long as you're securely rooted. You're not floating off someplace. So the same thing is true about Talmud Torah as represented by the Mishkan. The oil that's used to light the menorah is to counteract, so to speak, the feeling that you might have that the Torah is fossilized, that it was written down and put into the Aron Kodesh, never to be taken out again, and never to be changed. Whereas the menorah comes to tell us, and that's why it was important that after the Kelim were built in the parasha of Truma, that the Torah tells us, don't worry, it's not that the Aron HaKodesh has ultimate dominance over our lives, that we do the same thing as they did before us forever, but that the light of the menorah is really an extension of the Aron Kodesh, which is why it's not written down, as the Rabban points out, with the menorah, because it's not just the way to light the menorah. That's what the Nitziv tries to explain to us. That's just the way we light it, that you need oil and you need a wick. I mean, it's like, not just that. It's that it's the other side of the enterprise, so to speak. And the other side of the enterprise demands the ability to be novel in your thinking, to be original in the way you understand things. But of course, that only works if you're rooted in the Aron HaKodesh. If the Aron HaKodesh speaks to you as the product of Moshe Rabbeinu's teaching. Okay, have a good Shabbos.
Why wasn't the menorah inside the Kodesh of Kodesh also then?
I guess anything inside the Aron HaKodesh was stable. Everything was very stable. And the menorah is not stable.